Is the FBI still spying on traditional Catholics? A new congressional report indicates it is, but why? Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Congressman Jim Jordan, is here with an update. And bioethicist Father Tad Paholczyk reacts to the Department of Health and Human Services plan to reform the system of organ donation after flagrant failures. We'll also take you inside the amazing Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit at the Reagan Library. And The Blaze's Chris Bedford joins us with analysis of the rise of socialism in the U.S. And as the Trump administration issues a flurry of trade deals in Asia, Chinese hackers breach a major nuclear security facility in the U.S. Gordon Chang is here with analysis. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. And you can always find me at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. A July 22nd report from the House Judiciary Committee has found that the FBI spied on a Catholic priest for not divulging information about one of his parishioners. These findings harken back to the infamous leaked 2023 FBI memo revealing the Bureau's investigation into what they called radical traditionalist Catholic ties to the far-right white national movement. Joining me now to weigh in, please welcome United States Congressman from Ohio, Chair of the House Judiciary Committee, Jim Jordan. Congressman, thanks for being here. Now, we should mention this priest in question is a member of the Society of St. Pius X, which is at odds with the Vatican over its adherence to the pre-Vatican II liturgy, but their sacraments remain valid. Chairman Jordan, would you explain the circumstances of this investigation and how it came before your committee of this priest being surveilled?
Well, this goes back to the memorandum issued by the Richmond Field Office of the FBI, where it basically said if you're a pro-life Catholic, you're an extremist, and how they were targeting this specific church and specific parish, trying to get resources inside the church itself. But the report we released 2 days ago, I think there are really kind of two key takeaways. The first one is Christopher Wray doesn't appear to have been square with the committee. He said this was isolated just to the Richmond Field Office. Our investigation showed that was not the case. The Louisville Field Office was involved. The London FBI office was involved. This was a broader effort than just there. Second, he also didn't give us all the documents that we felt we were entitled to get in the investigation last Congress. We've now received those from Director Patel and from the FBI that he now is director of. So Chris Wray kept information from us, told us that this was an isolated incident. He was outraged by it. This is what he testified to, when in fact it wasn't. And then I think the other big takeaway is what they actually did to this specific priest in the parish there, in the church there in Richmond. That was, to me, what was the most egregious.
What did they do to him? And would this information be privileged, I mean, between the priest and the parishioner in question? I know the counterterrorism unit was involved. I mean, this is a crazy operation they launched against this, you know, local priest.
Yeah, they surveilled the priest. They actually got his credit card information, and looked at where he was going, what he was purchasing. And then they tried to, when they interviewed him, they tried to get him to divulge the information in the conversation that he had with the penitent. It's the priest-penitent confidentiality relationship, which is so privileged, which is the way it should be. Pastor, parishioner, priest, penitent, that's supposed to be confidential. And they tried to breach that. And their argument, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Their argument was, we didn't think this guy had been baptized. He wasn't a member of the Catholic faith, the Catholic Church. Like, what are you talking about? This is crazy. But that's what our FBI was up to. And maybe I should back up and say one other thing.
Yeah.
This was all based on what the Southern Poverty Law Center, much of the things they cited in that memorandum in the Richmond Field Office, was information from the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a left-wing group that says that Moms for Liberty are a terrorist group, that focus on the family is bad, that the Catholic Church is, I mean, this is what the Southern Poverty Law Center, that was the basis for developing the memorandum that led to the actions that we described in our report.
Yeah, and they targeted, and they called it in that memorandum, radical traditionalist Catholics. And again, they're using the Southern Poverty Law Center's tie-in that somehow this is all part of Christian nationalism. Here's my question. Why are they so obsessed with targeting particularly Christians, Chairman Jordan? Why did that become a fixation? And look, I get activists on the other side trying to, you know, tarnish and slander people that they consider adversaries. But why is the FBI getting involved in this?
It's all part of this left-wing narrative, I believe, and this attack on people who are, you know, traditional Christian, you know, mindset, church-going folks, people who actually have strong faith. I think it's part of this narrative. If you're pro-life, if you believe in you know, the sanctity of human life, if you think we should have a secure border, it was lumping all that in, but it was basically just adherence to left-wing ideology and attacking those people who are somehow different from that. That's not how our country is supposed to work. That's not how the First Amendment works, for goodness sake. So this was, I appreciate the good work of our team in putting this report together and highlighting just how egregious the behavior really was from certain elements of the FBI.
Well, you mentioned that the former director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, suppressed a lot of this information from your committee. Kash Patel offered it up. Are you confident now that based on this report, your conversations with the FBI, that culture has changed, not only in the Richmond office, but in these other offices that were involved in nationwide?
Great question. Yeah, great question. I will tell you, it certainly changed at the top. I had believed even before Cash took over as director that the vast majority of rank and file FBI agents were good people out there going after traditional bad guys and doing what the FBI is supposed to do. But I do think the culture at the top has changed. And we've saw it from day one. I think the second day that Director Patel is on the job, we sent him 7 subpoenas for information about this issue and a host of others. And the response and that we got from them was literally night and day compared to what it was like dealing with the Garland Justice Department and the Wray FBI. So I do think there's an entire change of culture. I have total confidence in Attorney General Bondi, Deputy Attorney General Blanche, and of course, Director Patel and his assistant, Dan Bongino, there at the FBI. Mm.
Chairman Jordan, before I let you go, this week, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard declassified documents that seem to indicate that this Russian hoax, this idea that Trump was colluding with the Russians, that this was the result of a weaponization of government involving Obama administration officials, Comey, Brennan, and even the former president himself. Now, Tulsi Gabbard's referred all of them to the DOJ for prosecution. Your thoughts on these alleged activities here by intelligence officials and the former president, and should they be prosecuted?
God bless Tulsi for doing the referral. I think that this is definitely should be examined by the Justice Department. The simple fact is they changed the report. They changed the assessment. The intelligence community assessment said Russia didn't hack the election, didn't involve Trump. There's no real evidence. And then they said, wait a minute, time out. They all come together at the White House. President Obama's there with Clapper and McCabe and Brennan and Rice and Lynch and all the key players. And President Obama says, time out, new assessment, put it together. And then that became the basis for undermining this whole attempt to undermine President Trump's first term. And it started literally before he took office. I always point to January 6, 2017, Comey, Clapper, Brennan traveled to New York to Trump Tower to give President-elect Trump his, what he believes is a defensive briefing that all incoming presidents are going to get from the intelligence committee. Here's the lay of the land, Mr. President, Mr. Incoming President. But it wasn't that. It was a setup. Because at that briefing, they talked to President Trump about the dossier. They know the dossier is garbage, but they share it with him nonetheless. And then that information is leaked. The fact that they shared the dossier, talked to the president-elect about the dossier, and thereby give credibility to a document that they know is garbage. That is just BS. Same document they used to get the FISA warrant to spy on his campaign. They now brief him about it and use that as a basis to leak it to the press and undermine his presidency, because it's all that leads to the Mueller investigation and everything else. So this was really bad what they did. And I point to this was the start, Raymond. It started here, and then it just kept going. It was Mueller. It was impeachment. It was the 51 former intel officials, the letter in the 2020 election. Then it was Jack Smith and all that. But it all started here, and we definitely need to get all the facts on the table. And if there was a crime, that individual or those individuals need to be prosecuted. So I appreciate what Tulsi's done. It is good work.
Congressman Jim Jordan, we'll leave it there, and we will check in with you in the days ahead. Thank you for your time and perspective.
You bet. Thank you.
The Dead Sea Scrolls transformed biblical understanding and are some of the earliest versions of the Hebrew Scriptures in existence. For a limited time, they're here in the United States on view at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California. We were there to explore the exhibit and the fascinating history of these scrolls. Melissa Giller is the Chief Marketing Officer at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. Tell me how and where were these Dead Sea Scrolls first discovered? How did they come here to the Reagan Library?
It's a crazy story. So 1947, a young male shepherder was out in the Judean desert near the Qumran Caves, tending to his sheep and his goats, and a goat escaped and went into the caves. And the teenager was lazy and didn't want to chase the goats into the cave, so he picked up a bunch of rocks on the ground and started throwing them into the cave to scare the goat out, and he heard the shattering of what ended up being pots. And he followed the sound, and lo and behold, he literally found the first Dead Sea Scroll.
Oh my God.
And that's how they were found.
And this is 1947?
1947. So then, between 47 and 65, they excavated the whole area, found all the scrolls, the objects, the artifacts. They're still excavating, and they're still finding things.
This, I have to tell you, this exhibit, though, is breathtaking. Mm-hmm. In that you have fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls with the oldest copy of the Ten Commandments.
Yes.
It's incredible. I mean, this goes right back, 2,000 years?
Yeah, everything in this exhibition is 2,000 years or older. And these scrolls, you know, were written, again, 2,000 years ago, not found until the 40s and 50s, and now they're on display. But because they are so precious, they're only allowed to be in the light for 3 months every 5 years. So as such, every 3 months, the Israel Antiquities Authorities come back out and rotate the scrolls. So we are on our third and final rotation of the scrolls. And the next museum that has this exhibition will have an entirely new set of scrolls because they have to be rested. So they take it very seriously, this preservation.
In 1947, they found these Dead Sea Scrolls. For the next decade, they find more jars, more scrolls. How are they preserved?
Well, it's crazy. So they believe one of the reasons why they survived for as long as they did is they were rolled up in dark caves that were dry. There's no sunlight. There's no humidity. They were really being preserved by the air and quality of which they were sort of held. Then they were found between 47 and 65. And they didn't know a lot about archaeology and preservation back then. And the archaeologists were smoking cigarettes over the fragments as they were piecing them back together. They were putting them together with scotch tape, which we know now, turns the documents yellow. So much damage was done in those first 20 years that the Israel Antiquities Authority say more damage was done in the 20 years than the 2,000 years that they were sitting in the caves.
Oh, my gosh.
But over the past couple of decades, they have worked to really put those preservation methods back in place, make sure these things are really well protected. In fact, they have this whole scientific way of looking at the scrolls without even unrolling them anymore. So they won't fall apart. They can actually use a technology, almost like an X-ray,
right,
to see what's inside without unrolling them.
I know you've had the rotation,
right. But
give folks a sense of what these Dead Sea Scrolls contained, and their fragments,
right. They
were shattered when they unrolled them.
Right. For the most part, they're fragments that have been pieced back together. And again, we have eight. When they found the scrolls, they found a scroll covering every single book of the Old Testament, with the exception of the book of Esther. If you can read Hebrew, the block letter of Hebrew that we read today is the same way they were written.
But the scrolls are not the only thing on display here.
In 1986, there was a drought in the Sea of Galilee, and when that water receded, what did they find but this? A first century fishing vessel. It's been called the Jesus boat. These are actual fragments of the vessel, but when you see this, it takes you right back to the first century.
Tell us about the Magdala Stone, which is really cool.
The Magdala Stone's incredible. It's never left Israel before. In fact, the Israel Antiquities Authority was telling us they think more people will see it here on display at the Reagan than have seen it in Israel. It's an incredible stone named for the city of Magdala where it was found, named for Mary Magdalene. Mm-hmm. They believe that perhaps Jesus actually prayed there and was in the area, which is why it was named Mary Magdalene, for Mary Magdala. Mm-hmm. But the stone itself, they believe, was used to hold Torah scrolls in the Second Temple, that it was a piece of furniture. Mm-hmm. But what makes it so unique is that on its front is carved a seven-branch menorah, and they believe it's the oldest known carving of a seven-branch menorah to exist.
Yeah, it's really...
It's beautiful.
I mean, it's incredible.
All the artifacts are like that, and you know, so many people can't get to Israel for a variety of reasons, mm-hmm. and we've basically brought Israel to them, because not only are these incredible artifacts from 2,000 years old, but we have a real piece of the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, and we encourage people to leave prayers and notes just as you would if you were in Jerusalem, and so you can kind of sort of bringing Israel to you in a sense.
What about these ossuaries?
Yes. So we have three, I believe, as part of this exhibition, and they were basically bone boxes. And they were used to hold and contain the bones of their loved ones that were deceased. And during the excavation, they found a handful of them, and three of them are on display.
Hmm. What's the thing that's most surprised you about this exhibit?
I'm Jewish, and I can sort of read Hebrew. Ah. So I can sort of read the scrolls. But that said, the Western Wall, every time I'm next to it, I'm moved. Mm. I cannot walk by it without touching it. By constantly laying my hand on it and just feel just a sense of purpose in doing it. Mm. I think that's what's most surprised me. It is really an exhibition for everybody to really learn about the early formations of Judaism and Christianity and how people lived back then and how some of the ways they lived back then are still in that exhibit. There are 2,000-year-old dice made out of bone, but they look exactly like the dice we use today.
We still use.
It literally looks like Yahtzee dice.
The other thing that struck me is to have within the possession of humanity all of the Psalms and some deep cuts that we've never seen before.
Yes.
I mean, that was the shocker to me. I didn't realize there were extra Psalms that didn't make
The first set of eight scrolls we had on display when we first opened, one was from the Book of Psalms. And that was actually a real scroll, meaning it wasn't just fragments. You could see the whole scroll.
Yeah.
And in that scroll contained some of the Psalms that we are used to from the Book of Psalms. Mm-hmm. But it also included two Psalms that are not in the Book of Psalms. And one was about how he was chosen to sort of, you know, be the king and carry the gospel. And he talks about, you know, I didn't have the beautiful hair like my brother had. I didn't have the looks that my brothers had, but yet I was chosen.
Wow.
So really special things that were found in these scrolls.
Why do you think it is this exhibit on the Dead Sea Scrolls and all of this adjacent, these touchstones of an age, why is it a good fit for the Reagan Library?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's easy. Ronald Reagan believed so strongly in his Christian faith, in faith in general, in prayer, in God. He didn't care what religion you were. He just believed in faith itself.
Yeah.
He would have loved this exhibition so much. He met with Jewish leaders throughout his entire time as president, of course, his entire life. And for him, I mean, faith really was his core. Good, decency, churchgoer, all of those different types of things.
My thanks to Melissa Giller and all the folks at the Reagan Library for making that interview possible. The Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit is showing now through September 2nd at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum. Visit ReaganFoundation.org for all the details. At least two major cities in the U.S. are seeing Muslim socialist mayoral candidates having success in primary elections. And the U.S. Catholic bishops continue to place themselves in the middle of the politics of immigration. With analysis of these stories and more, we're joined by political commentator, senior political editor at The Blaze, Chris Bedford. Chris, thanks for being here. Last month, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the president, Archbishop Timothy Broglio, issued a statement on immigration in which he affirmed support for all immigrants, regardless of their status. Then, last Sunday, Miami Archbishop Wenske led a motorcycle ride with a group of 25 members of the Knights of Columbus, Knights on Bikes, to the gates of the Alligator Alcatraz detention facility. He held a prayer service, a rally there, a rosary for the men and women inside. Wenske has requested to be allowed to offer mass inside the facility, but That has yet to be granted. Just this week, Archbishop Nelson Perez of Philadelphia issued a pastoral letter on immigration in support of the migrant community and asking for comprehensive immigration reform. Chris, your thoughts on the growing number of Catholic bishops taking a stand on this issue of immigration and involving themselves in the political debate. Why do you think they're so attached to this issue?
I think that it's complicated, right? I mean, there is a Catholic call to charity. There's a Catholic call to mercy on the prisoner. There's a Catholic call to prayer, to come and pray for people who are detained and people who have committed crimes or people who are going through hardship. And I understand that, but sometimes it seems a little disordered, the different order that is given to which politically expedient person is above the others. Does the junkie fit in with the illegal immigrant? Does that person fit in with the murderer? Does that person fit in, whoever else broke the law? Mm-hmm. Where do the unborn come in here? Where does the sanctity of marriage come involved in this? Where was so many of these bishops when it was simply Cardinal Leone out there fighting for the Eucharist during COVID and saying you can't close the churches? That part, with that silence was deafening. So I'm happy to see the bishops engaged in public life. I'm extremely unhappy to see places like Catholic Charities taking so much money from the government and taking so much money from foreign governments and from international non-state actors to try and subvert countries' immigration laws. But at the end of the day, you have to protect the country you're in and obey the laws that you're in and the people there. Now, some of these priests are going to be torn because they have a lot of parishioners, people who come there and pray in their church who may be fearful that they're going to be deported because they came here, they broke the law, or they've got family or people that they know and care about who broke the law. There's a kind of a pastoral role for priests in there to try and help those people and guide those people. But it got to end at pushing for people to break the law or saying that there should be no borders. That's not something that the Vatican acknowledges, and it's not something that the West, the Catholic West, has ever acknowledged. And it's something that's political now.
Well, look, I know some bishops have expressed concern about the state of this alligator Alcatraz facility. They say it's dehumanizing. Maybe it's the title. But in reality, there are federal standards, Chris, for all these facilities, which this alligator Alcatraz apparently meets those standards. Your thoughts on this and the reticence to offer pastoral care at that particular place, which is something I have to say. I don't understand why they wouldn't allow that.
Yeah, if a priest or a bishop asks to give mass, then you should allow that priest or bishop to give mass. Of course, you have to be careful if that priest or bishop is an activist who's shown ulterior motives, someone who may put the guards in danger. A lot of those guards and a lot of the agents down there, people who I've known representing the federal government and reporters that I've sent representing the news media to Alligator Alcatraz are all Catholic. A large number of them are. So it's on all sides of this. You can't put the guards in danger. But the people who I know, good church-going, prayerful Catholics who have mercy in their heart and just want to see the laws of this country followed and get dangerous people out of this country, people we don't know, who are Catholic, who are down there, have told me that it's an uncomfortable place to be, for sure. It's a temporary place to be. It's a detainment center in an uncomfortable part of the country. But it is meeting federal standards. It's not like people are starving. The complaints there from some of the prisoners has been that the bread's not toasted. Well, that historically is not a really serious complaint to have about your detainment when you've broken the law.
Yeah, and they have air conditioning. They have medical facilities there.
Yes.
I mean, I've spoken to a number of people who've been on site. I think, again, the title frightens people when they hear alligator Alcatraz. Unless they're feeding the immigrants to the alligators, it's not a problem. Chris, my father was an immigrant who followed the law, got a sponsor, served in the military, and became a citizen. Yet there's this tendency, especially among some in the hierarchy, to conflate immigrants following the law, following the process, checking in with the government, working towards citizenship with those who crash the borders and are in violation of the law. Does this really appeal to Catholic voters when Catholic hierarchs refuse to make that distinction clear?
No, I think it's a turnoff. And I think that a lot of the Democratic policies have been a turnoff as well. A lot of for example, the state that's right near where I'm at right now, Maryland, where we're both at, is one, their Democratic senator went down to El Salvador, and he was trying to free this Maryland man who was associated with MS-13, who was here illegally. And all of the subtitles for his video were not in Spanish. He wasn't talking to his Spanish constituents, his Spanish language constituents. He was talking to his English constituents. They were his white women, Democratic women constituents. All the subtitles were in English. Those are the main constituency for this. If you talk to members of the Customs and Border Patrol, which is constantly villainized by the Democratic Party, huge numbers of them are Hispanic. Huge numbers of them are children of immigrants, people who came here legally through the process. And if you look at the polling in favor of deportations, it is extremely high amongst the immigrant communities, the legal immigrant communities, because those are the neighborhoods, not mine, most likely not yours, where MS-13 is a threat, where our children are being drawn into gangs, where violence is a daily problem because of illegal immigrants. So they're in favor of it, and there's a disconnect there from some of the hierarchy.
Yeah. A Massachusetts federal judge on Tuesday issued a ruling blocking a provision in the One Big Beautiful Bill that stopped taxpayer funding of Planned Parenthood and other abortion centers. In a July 21st ruling, a federal judge decided that the law does not apply to abortion businesses like Planned Parenthood and granted the organization's request for a temporary injunction while the lawsuit progresses. Chris, you'll be hard-pressed to find a reaction from the U.S. bishops on this very pro-life bill, one they have asked for decades, the defunding of Planned Parenthood. And once again, give me your thoughts on that, and then your thoughts on this federal judge frustrating the will of Congress.
I don't think it's particularly surprising on the bishop's part. That's why I agree with the old Holy Roman Emperor Leopold, Ferdinand, who said that he would sooner get off his horse to carry the lowly parish priest on his shoulder and just as quickly put the bishop in prison in the high tower, because there's such a difference between the bishops and the priests in so many of these circumstances and their interests in what they're going after. And if you go and look at the staff of the College of Cardinals, there's a couple people, particularly in the abortion office, who are very hardline, who are very traditional, who take their Catholic duty seriously. But so many of the other staff are left-wing activists. That's what brought them here, and they use it just another one of their NGOs, another one of their tools to push these sorts of things. And this Massachusetts judge is totally emblematic of a thing that we've seen with judges from Massachusetts before, from California and from around the country. People who never would have been confirmed if there was still a filibuster on federal judges and you needed 60 votes. Left-wing activists who are continuously flouting the Congress, flouting the presidency, and flouting the Supreme Court because they know that this is going to be a path to promotion if Democrats ever come back to power. And they care more about that than they care about the actual law, which is a problem.
Zoran Mamdani, we have to talk about him. He's that New York State Assembly member, a Democratic socialist running for mayor in New York City, Chris. He's campaigning on raising income tax on the 1% of New Yorkers, freezing rents on rent-controlled apartments, and he plans to build a city-owned grocery store in each borough. Now, he's been making the rounds here in D.C., getting the endorsement of the Democratic establishment. What is the allure of socialism and socialists in this moment? And is there a danger for the Democratic Party aligning itself with these figures?
Oh, there's a huge danger for the Democratic Party because then they're going to end up owning the results of this, the ruin that these sort of policies bring on proud cities and proud American cities. Now, this is another problem for the elites. This is a problem that has been caused in large part by that 1% in New York City and previous mayors and governors in New York, which is that the rent in New York is astronomical. The living conditions are deplorable for huge numbers of people. Huge amounts of people are forced to live like insects in essentially filthy hives with terrible landlords and rising rent if they're not in rent-controlled places. And when you don't take care of that, when you don't have more common sense solutions to actually solving this sort of thing, you're going to get a populist outrage. The United States was close to having a Bernie Sanders. Donald Trump ended up harnessing that instead and moving in a different direction. But that rage, that feeling that the middle class is being hollowed out, that American dream is no longer affordable, that people can't get what their parents had and never have a shot at, and their children are in even more trouble, is continuing to grow in a lot of these places, and socialism will take advantage of that and ruin it if it's not addressed.
In another closely watched mayoral race, and it feels like New York, Minnesota State Senator Omar Fatah is running for mayor of Minneapolis. Now, he also is a Muslim Democrat socialist. Mr. Fatah received the endorsement of Minnesota's version of the Democratic Party, the chapter there, over the two-term incumbent Democrat Jacob Frey. Now, Chris, Minneapolis is the first major U.S. city to have a Muslim call of prayer broadcast over loudspeakers multiple times a day. What do you make of the increasing number of Muslim candidates finding political success here and this idea of socialism being merged with the Islamic, at least, messaging that affects and reaches so many parts of that community already in place?
A moderate Muslim friend warned me about this 10 years ago. He called it the Red-Green Alliance, that these are people who seem like they don't have shared values, but they do in their hatred of the Christian West and their wish, their belief that is completely unjust, in that this is about the haves and the have-nots, or the oppressed and the oppressors, as opposed to civilization versus barbarism or Christianity versus the great void. And it's also a failure, but it's also a failure of the secular state and the secular left, that they don't understand that they can't just ask that there not be a God in the public space. There will be a God. And if the Christian God is not represented, then Muhammad will be his prophet. And that's what you're going to get in places like this. That's what you're getting in England and other places have drifted away from actually having beliefs, because a lot of these candidates, a lot of these immigrants do believe in their religion. They do believe that there's right and wrong, and they believe that their religion is right and yours is wrong. So if you don't stand up, then you're going to end up with foreign religions that are completely anathema to Western values and the secularism that was preached that allowed it here, and it's going to replace you.
It breaks your heart when you see these beautiful old Catholic churches, you know, in Buffalo, in parts of the Midwest, and they're being sold and transformed into mosques. But, you know, people say, oh, this is terrible. Well, it's also the effect of when you don't properly teach the faith. When you scandalize people over a long series of years, they scatter. They don't come. And if you don't have people in the pews, you can't keep the building open. So the architecture, the loss of the architecture is just the tip of the iceberg. That's kind of the leading indicator that something's wrong. The problem is, it seems so many in the church are not willing to take that introspection and say, wait a minute, what caused this? How did we build these magnificent cathedrals and churches all over the country and the world, and why are we losing them today?
That's our role. The state can't do it. The Christians have to do it themselves. The church has to do it.
Yeah. Final question. Late night comedian Stephen Colbert's Late Show has been canceled after 10 years. I did a full autopsy of the Colbert Show and others like it, and how I think they distorted the form of late night, and that's what led to their demise. That's on the Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. But I want to get your reaction to the reaction. Some partisans suggest the show was canceled to appease President Trump as his administration oversees the CBS Paramount merger. This is Sonny Hostin of The View.
If it is political, this is the dismantling of our democracy. This is the dismantling of our Constitution, right?
Chris, is the Colbert cancellation really a threat to democracy and the Constitution?
No, and he's so far removed from Johnny Carson. I've laughed more times at the reaction to this show's cancellation than I did during his 10-year run actually hosting this show, because it wasn't funny. It was political. It didn't try to reach all Americans. It tried to reach a certain segment, which is now up in arms. By the way, there's very few people who are still watching it. It was losing $40 million a year. People weren't paying attention. The only reason it was even remotely relevant is because the news companies that own it would pretend that it was relevant and include it in their reporting as if this was important commentary. It wasn't. It was a charity case. And it's easy for the left to try and blame Donald Trump for everything. But sometimes their own failures are responsible. And this is one of those cases.
We will leave it there. Chris Medford, thank you so much. You can read Chris's columns at theblaze.com. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
And this week on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I talked with iconic actor Donnie Most. We did a deep dive into the magic of classic television. Why did it work? From his breakout role as Ralph Malph on Happy Days to the cultural glue that classic TV shows provided for the country. The entire Arroyo Grande show is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show. Or wherever you get your podcasts, take us with you, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. Be sure to check it out. Subscribe. You don't want to miss an episode. And we have a blistering new installment of The Prayerful Posse. That's this Friday. Is Pope Leo offering hope to the Latin Mass community? Visit RaymondArroyo.com for all those links. Don't miss that. And the Department of Health and Human Services, under Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., is announcing this week that they will initiate a sweeping overhaul of the nation's organ donation system due to what they call a horrifying ethical failure. Joining me with analysis of this development is neuroscientist, senior ethicist at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, Father Tad Poholchik. Father, thank you for being here. HHS conducted a four-year investigation into the nation's organ transplant system, which revealed systemic ethical and safety violations. In a June 21st press release, the HHS Secretary Kennedy stated the following. It revealed that hospitals allowed the organ procurement process to begin when patients show signs of life. The entire system must be fixed to ensure that every potential donor's life is treated with the sanctity it deserves. Father, the HHS found systemic disregard for sanctity of life. What's going on here?
So, Raymond, I'm very pleased with this initiative, I have to tell you. I was delighted just to see the title of the press release and the use of the term sanctity of life. I was thinking to myself, boy, did we hear that under the Biden administration? Not really. And, you know, then rather strong language coming from HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., because he referred to the fact that potential donors' lives were being treated in a bad way as horrifying. In other words, that they showed signs of life and they were still moving ahead with procuring organs. So horrifying is a strong word. What this does, in my opinion, this puts the organ procurement organizations on notice. And in my opinion, this is something that has been long in coming. I'm glad to hear that this study has 4 years of digging, you know, in the background. I understand some of the findings that had previously been looked at by the Biden administration were sort of sidelined, but it sounds like some of those are being, you know, reinvigorated and examined again, which is so important to be sure that justice is done to potential donors here.
Father Tad, the church teaches in the catechism that organ donation after death is a noble and meritorious act, while establishing ethical guidelines for the need for free and informed consent. Explain the church's ethical stipulations and how current practice in the organ donation and procurement system can or has violated those guidelines.
Yeah, so, you know, the key rule here we call the dead donor rule. That's what the catechism is touching on. We have a real obligation to make sure that life-sustaining organs are never removed before the donor is properly determined and declared to be dead. And also, of course, you know, the obvious corollary to that would be that donors of organs cannot be killed for the purpose of obtaining their organs. So the HHS report indicates that there has been some clear failures in procedure here. And, you know, some of the follow-up that I've seen on this, there have been workers in various states who have reported that some of these coordinators for the organ procurement organizations have been persuading people in hospitals to, you know, administer higher doses of morphine or other drugs to hasten the death of potential donors, those kinds of things. And of course, that's strictly forbidden by the dead donor rule. And, you know, you mentioned consent. The church is very strong on this. This is a voluntary choice that individuals can make. There's no obligation to do it. We should not have a position like they do in Europe where there's implied consent, which means if you drop dead, they can come and take your organs. No, there's a need to get that consent ahead of time. And if not, then from your properly appointed proxy, the person who makes your decisions because you're unconscious or or brain dead. You need to be brain dead, actually, in order to donate. But you can have, you know, you ask about how is this done? You can have a situation where a person is very close to death and they are clearly on the way out. They're on a ventilator and a decision by the family is made to remove the ventilator and wait till the person passes, which can happen in a matter of minutes or maybe in an hour or two. And then at that point, after waiting at least 5 minutes, that's the bare minimum, the doctors are permitted to go in and start extracting organs for the transplant, assuming again that consent was obtained. Now, I mentioned the 5 minutes. This has been another problem that the HHS report, alludes to. Some places look like they're doing 3 minutes or less. And, you have to be sure, you have to have what we call moral certainty that the person is deceased. You do not want to start cutting when they are not yet deceased.
Well, these organ procurement organizations, they take a number of things into account when they obtain organs for eventual donation or transplant. And brain death, circulatory death, those are the two, benchmarks. But there have been violations that the HHS found, literal ambulance chasing and, jumping ahead, as you mentioned a moment ago, to obtain these organs. What is driving all of this? I mean, is it to preserve the organs in their best state, or is this related to a financial motive?
It's probably both. I mean, when you think about what these organ procurement organizations are up against, they're called into the hospital. When they get there, they don't want to have a kind of, failure to achieve their goal. They don't want to have to be sent back home again. So as soon as they're there, they're very eager. Some people, unfortunately, have said they're even a bit like vultures hanging around waiting. The procedures here are easy to violate. They can apply pressure in a manner that they really shouldn't. And so I think the protocols, there needs to be a certain strengthening of this. And what this means practically, Raymond, is there needs to be first increased monitoring of how this is done. There need to be improved safeguards in the whole
Well, I
process.
was just about to ask you, what are the safeguards that HHS is proposing here to stop this abuse? And what safeguards are already in place that obviously people aren't paying very much attention to?
Well, one of the safeguards that's already in place is that the organ procurement organization doctors are not supposed to be in touch with the healthcare team who's taking care of the person who's dying or has just died. That's supposed to be, two separate channels and wires that don't cross. And hopefully that's the case, but I have heard stories where sometimes those wires do get crossed. In terms of, changes that they are requiring, it looks like the HHS is going to mandate that the organ procurement organization carry out a full kind of root cause analysis of all the violations that you and I are talking about here, including this, non-compliance with the 5 minute waiting rule after the patient's death. And I think, the reason a lot of these organ procurement organizations may rush things is they say, well, these people are going to die anyway. They've agreed to be donors. Why do we have to wait 5 minutes? That sort of thing. But of course, it's very important that we do. And there's also this new thing, which I think is a very good safeguard, which is that the organ procurement organization has to adopt a formal procedure so that if there's a staff member there who's helping out with the donation process and they see some kind of a safety concern, a violation, they can halt the whole process. So, in other words, Raymond, what I think is important here is we need to err on the side of caution. Life is so sacred. We want our whole medical institution to reverence that life right up until the point that it has passed out of this world and not begin anything preliminarily.
And Father, are you confident these reforms will fix the problem? I mean, can the system be trusted? And what do you make of the temptation of a lot of these procurement organizations and hospitals to cut corners and skirt these ethical regulations?
Well, I have to say, Raymond, I'm not confident necessarily, but I'm strongly encouraged. Let's put it that way. The fact that this is coming into full broad daylight, this is great. This is something that should have happened, much sooner, in my view. So, will it fix everything? Will it make the system perfect? No, nothing ever does. I mean, we always have flawed humans, even as physicians, who are mediating this entire process. But when you set up good safeguards, improve accountability, I think that what's going to happen here is we are going to move towards a restoration of trust. And this is good. We want to be able to trust our healthcare professionals. So this is what I consider to be a fairly sweeping reform. And, it really could be a plus all the way around.
As I read this press release and as we're talking, I'm thinking of people I know who have living wills, do not resuscitate orders, or, you know, even denying themselves hydration and nutrition, allowing the health provider to basically make that call. When you couple that with a donation, be it implicit or not, with a donation of organs, there seems to be a conflict of interest there, Father, don't you think?
I would agree. And I, you know, what you're pointing out about allowing the healthcare team to make decisions about providing nutrition and hydration, that's something we should not be encouraging, Raymond. Instead, there needs to be the properly appointed healthcare proxy, somebody who loves you, who cares for you. They can make those decisions together with in consultation with the healthcare team, but yeah. You should not be handing this over to the doctors and nurses. They are not the ones who are going to have, you know, automatically the best interests of the patient in mind.
Well, particularly if you've got an incentive here where you've got the, you know, the organ procurement people waiting in the hallway. There's an incentive to move things along, free up the bed, and get the organ out. So, all of this is very troubling to me, I have to say. But I thank you for bringing light and some hope to the situation. And you can find Father Tad Poholchik's commentary on the National Catholic Bioethics Center website, ncbcenter.org. Thank you, Father Tad.
Thanks so much, Raymond.
The Trump administration unveiled a slew of new trade deals in Asia this week. Chinese nationals continue to spy on the U.S. homeland, and Chinese hackers managed to breach a major U.S. nuclear security facility. Joining me with analysis of this and more, attorney, author, and foreign policy expert Gordon Chang. Gordon, thanks for being here. The U.S. reached a trade deal with the Philippines this week. You saw Ferdinand Marcos, rather, Jr., at the White House. The president also announced a major trade agreement with Japan. Gordon, what do these trade deals mean for the U.S. and the countries of Asia, particularly Japan, the Philippines, China, and Taiwan?
The most important thing is that for decades, we've had one-way trade with the world. We've had an open market, and other countries have closed theirs, not only with tariffs, but even more important, non-tariff barriers. And what is happening right now is President Trump has said, look, we're just not putting up with this anymore. And that is the context. But when we look at some of these deals, such as Japan and the Philippines, these are really important from a geopolitical point of view as well, because China, our enemy, is threatening Japan. They're threatening the Philippines. They're threatening Indonesia, all of these countries. And what we're doing is we are knotting together these countries with us into a global trade deal, in a sense, and that is excluding the Chinese.
U.S. Secretary of the Treasury Scott Bessent said on Tuesday that he's going to meet with Chinese officials in Stockholm to discuss a deadline extension of negotiating a trade deal with China. Now, he says trade with China is in a good place, Gordon. He also said China's dependence on Iran and Russia for oil is a key issue in those upcoming trade talks. What can we expect from those talks with China? And is there a danger of decoupling trade from human rights and religious concerns there?
Yeah, I think that in Stockholm next week, the Chinese are going to stall. Remember, we had a May 12th agreement with them, which the Chinese, by the way, have already violated. But there was a 90-day pause, and that ends on the 12th of next month. The Chinese are going to ask for an additional time, and we shouldn't give it to them because they've been just dragging their feet. But, you know, the important thing is that by trading with a Chinese regime, we're strengthening it. That regime has declared us to be its enemy. That regime has killed Americans, not only with COVID, but with fentanyl as part of deliberate policies. So, no, we shouldn't decouple trade from human rights and from our relations with China. It was absolutely the wrong thing for Clinton to do in the 1990s. It's absolutely the wrong thing to do at our decade as well.
Yeah. Gordon, you wrote in The Hill that the Trump administration will grant licenses to NVIDIA Corp so that it can sell those H20 chips to Chinese parties. But we know that in April, Trump officials had prohibited the sale of H20s in that country. What happened here? Why this reversal?
I think the reversal is that after that May 12 trade agreement, China promised to lift the embargo of the export of rare earths to the United States. But it didn't do that. So to get China to honor its promises, we've given them additional concessions. And one of those additional concessions is to sell the H20 plus also AMD's new chip as well. So really, this is an additional benefit for China. In other words, what we've given China is an incentive to violate the next trade deal with us. So this is not good policy from any number of different perspectives.
Yeah, and anytime you trade intellectual property with the Chinese, expect it to be extinct any minute because they're going to copy it and create their own version, as they've done in multiple industries that we've shared with them or been in partnership with the China and American corporations. But two Chinese nationals were charged. And this is why the whole thing blows my mind. Two Chinese nationals are charged with acting as foreign agents and spying on the U.S. Navy to gather intelligence and enlist other agents. Now, this is according to the Department of Justice. This is a press release. They appeared in federal court, these two Chinese nationals, on June 30th, to face charges issued by the Northern District of California regarding illegal clandestine activities on behalf of China's primary intelligence agency. Here's the quote. These activities included facilitating a dead drop payment of cash for information relating to the national security of the United States previously provided to the MSS, gathering intelligence about U.S. Navy service members and bases, and assisting with efforts to recruit other individuals from within the United States military as potential MSS assets. Gordon, what are these cases of Chinese nationals being caught spying in the U.S.? Tell us about China's strategy, and should we be trading with them at all, given this?
Yeah, China has the most comprehensive campaign to obtain information out of the U.S., and they do it legally, but in this case, it was also illegally. And we have seen China go after our secrets, including some of our most important ones, including the Department of Energy a couple days ago, our nuclear weapons agencies. Mm-hmm. So really what we have got is just a comprehensive assault on our secrets. And by the way, the story here is that we've allowed our networks to be compromised. So this is a story of American obliviousness and negligence, as well as China's maliciousness.
Hmm. Gordon, tens of millions of Android and iPhone users are being warned. If they've installed free apps, they could be at serious risk. Now, those users could now be sending sensitive data to companies under the control of the Chinese government. We know that TikTok was a concern, but now it's other apps as well. How dangerous are these apps in the aggregate?
Well, in the aggregate, they are taking information from our young, for instance. And people will say, well, who cares about a 17-year-old? Mm. But look, every president of the United States, every Supreme Court justice, every senator, every representative, every governor was once a 17-year-old. And China is getting a lot of information that they can use to compromise our future leaders. Mm. So, you know, the Chinese don't allow our apps. So I don't see why we're allowing China's apps in our country. We should follow India's example and just ban TikTok and other Chinese apps.
Yeah. Well, this again, when you have pressure from these corporations, the American policymakers start to buckle. And they say, well, look, there's money to be made and we're killing an industry. What about free speech? This isn't free speech. It's foreign surveillance. And I don't think we've quite gotten that in the heads. The populace doesn't understand it. Let's be honest, Gordon. And I think the policymakers in D.C., there's an incentive to ignore it or look over it. That's a bad, bad tell. If TikTok was sucking up our information 4 years ago, and that was the big fear, and we took government officials and agents off of those apps, why did it suddenly become okay this week? I don't understand any of this. But let's get to this. Last week, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un told Russia's top diplomat his country was ready to, quote, unconditionally support Moscow's every effort to resolve the conflict in Ukraine as the two countries held high-level strategic talks. The two countries' foreign ministers held their second strategic dialogue, pledging further cooperation under this partnership treaty that they signed last year. Gordon, relations between Russia and North Korea have really deepened during this war in Ukraine. North Korea's deployed more than 10,000 troops and arms to Russia to back Moscow's campaign. What are you hearing about this alliance, and will it continue to grow?
I think it'll continue to grow because the United States is not doing anything to make sure the North Koreans pay for this. You know, and it's not just that North Korea now provides about 40% or so of Russian munitions used in the war. There are reports that North Korea is going to send another 30,000 troops to the front. When you're talking about a war of attrition where the Ukraine is being ground down slowly, this is really important. And by the way, they're not only North Korean troops there, they're Chinese troops as well. There's Chinese mercenaries, but there's also People's Liberation Army officers there, presumably as observers or advisors, but there's going to be more Chinese presence in the front in Ukraine.
There was an announcement today, Gordon, that when I saw it, I thought I should bring it to your attention. The United Kingdom is reintroducing extradition cooperation with Hong Kong, meaning they will send former Hong Kong residents now living in Britain back to China should the Chinese, or in this case Hong Kong, you know, standing in front of the Chinese regime, should they request these residents to be returned for extradition. Your thoughts on this?
Incomprehensible. You know, this is the Carl Starmer government is not only thinking of this, but it's also thinking of allowing China to have that mega embassy, which is going to be a threat to security in not only Great Britain, but remember, Great Britain is a Five Eyes partner. There are all sorts of things that are going on which are, you know, just inconsistent with having a democracy. And so we've got to have some really tough conversations with London on this, because we should have no extradition relations with China, Hong Kong, or Macau.
Yeah, I mean, these are, and just so people understand, Hong Kong residents shared a dual citizenship with China, and they were British citizens, because at that time Britain owned, or they were just British citizens. They weren't even Chinese citizens, were they, Gordon?
Well, they had something called British Overseas Nationality.
Uh-huh.
And also, some people in Hong Kong actually had real British nationality. For instance, Jimmy Lai,
right,
who is now rotting away in a Chinese, in a Hong Kong jail.
Mm-hmm. So the idea here is the Chinese authorities can request British citizens, essentially, to be brought back to the Chinese mainland if they lived in Hong Kong. This is madness. This really is bizarre. When I saw that story, my eyes popped out of my head. But the world looks the other way, Gordon, and maybe they shouldn't. I'll give you the last
word. Yeah, this is really serious with what China's been able to do to get democracies to bend to as well. And it's not just Britain. It's Australia, where we had the Australian Prime Minister go to Beijing in his craven, just really awful display of appeasement. And then, you know, we have in our country so many people who do the same thing. So this is serious. We have to have some honest conversations with the American people about who our friends are and who our enemy is.
Well, and to give you an idea of how deep the tentacles of the Chinese reach, I know a number of media personalities here in the United States who have been offered literally millions of dollars to publicly join TikTok, to wash it in the public domain so that it becomes okay for people to join because of the reticence after the fallout with Mike Pompeo and Trump in the first administration. It's an amazing, the power that China wields via funds and monetary inducements. They're flying these influencers into the Chinese mainland to make it look all sunny and like a fun destination. This is insidious because it's ignoring the human rights and the deep religious persecution that's going on in that country. Gordon, we will leave it there. We thank you for keeping us abreast of all of this. You're one of the few trusted sources analyzing and reporting what's actually happening. We thank you for that. Gordon Chang, you can find Gordon on X at Gordon G. Chang. Thank you.
Thank you, Raymond.
That is all the time we have for now, but be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thanks for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.